WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Academy Award-winning director Milos Forman. His movies include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, Amadeus, and Valmont. Forman began his career working under the communist bureaucracy in his native country, Czechoslovakia. His Czech movie, Fireman's Ball, played at the New York Film Festival in 1967 and was his ticket to the U.S. Forman has written a memoir called Turnaround. Forman was a child during World War II when the Gestapo were in charge. After the war in 1948, the communists took over. Both of Forman's parents died in Nazi death camps. His father was on the fringes of the underground. One of the Nazis responsible for the death of Forman's parents had been one of their employees years before.
My parents built a very small 15-room pension, or little hotel, if you want, in former Sudetenland, which was the part of Czechoslovakia which was taken over by the Nazis first, by the Germans first. And as a kind of a foreman on the building of this pension in 1920-something, I was not even born, was a German citizen there who, and I know that my parents were very fair people and they treated him fairly, but when the Nazi came to power, suddenly this man, of course, was somehow humiliated that he worked for some Czechs, which is, you know, not a race or nation, which is, you know, up to the Nazi or German stature. And by sheer coincidence, this man ended up in the Gestapo in Kolín, which was the town under which Czaslav, a little town in the middle of Bohemia, was under. And when he got all these names, and he saw the names of my parents, first my father and then my mother, he just stamped the paper with a stamp which said the return undesirable. And that's it. And then they perished.
Your mother was taken by the Gestapo after they came to search your house. What was it like? You were, I think, 7 years old or something?
With mother, I was 8 and a half. Yeah, I was 8 and a half years old. I was sick that day, and I was, I had a fever, I had a flu, I was in bed, and I heard, you know, that that some voices downstairs, because we were living in a little house, you know, one-story house in Czaslav, and for a long time, and I knew that something is strange, because I heard that strange noises from downstairs, and then I hear steps coming upstairs, and then the door open a crack, and my mother is there, and she's handing me a cup of water and a pill, and says, "Now take the pill," and I said, "But I shouldn't be taking the pill until the afternoon." The Gestapo is here. And she just gave me that. So I took the pill and I, you know, the door closed. I saw a man standing behind her there. And then I realized why she's telling me that, because I was, my bedroom was a tiny little room behind which was another tiny little room to which the door were covered by a cupboard. And to keep the fresh air in, the cupboard was always a little bit away from the door. And I realized that she wants me to push the cupboard back to the wall so that it covers the door. And when they come to my bedroom to for search, that they will not find it. But I was too weak, and the cupboard was oak wood and very, very heavy. I took all the things out, and I was trying to push it back and push it back, and I didn't succeed. That was the most horrible feeling, because I felt like I failed my family. The irony is that then when they came in and found out, you know, this other room there, they went in, they looked around, they went out, they were even smiling at me. And then they went down again with my mother. But then I hear the door click, and then there was silence. And this was, you know, they came like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was silence. And I hear the car going away from in the street, and there is a total silence. They just didn't even let my mother go upstairs and say goodbye, and I am alone, absolutely alone in the whole house, and there was nobody in the town of Czaslav, you know, who would come home.
So that's the last time you ever saw your mother?
No, then we had a very, you know, sort of, it's everything is such a paradox, you know. About a year later, suddenly we were allowed a visit with our mother. Me, my brother, and my uncle, you know, my mother's brother. So we went to Prague. We were taken down to the catacombs of a former bank, which was now at Gestapo headquarters in Prague. And we are, they, you know, locked us in, closed the door, and we are sitting there, my brother, my uncle, for about over 2 hours. And then the door opens, and in the door, they brought in my mother. And from the in the first moment, I realized she didn't know why where they are taking her. They obviously didn't tell her that she's not going to be interrogated or whatever, that she's going to meet her family. And we had 10 minutes allowed with her. And the funny paradox is that, you know, what do you... And now when I recall it, all we were talking about, mother was asking, oh, how were the prunes this year? And did you have enough sugar to make a jam? And how is Mrs. Procházková? It was absolute, and she was just holding me all these 10 minutes, you know. And then the man said, you know, goodbye, and say goodbye. So the mother left, never saw her again.
So what was it like for you to go through the rest of the war without parents?
Well, that's another big paradox. You know, a child doesn't really perceive the tragedy like that. Especially, you know, I probably would be much more stricken by grief if my parents died yesterday than when they died when I was a child. And because child doesn't really perceive the finality of life. The death is, especially in these cases, because they were away. They were somewhere.
Right, you didn't know they were going to die.
So you don't know they are going to die. They are somewhere. And then one day... Somebody tells you, in this case, it was my uncle, told me, listen, my sister, your mother died. But in my daily life, nothing changed. You know.
So you had family, extended family to bring you up, uncles?
Oh, my relatives were taking care of me, yes.
I want you to recall a specific day during the war, and this is a day that must have had special significance for you. It's the day that the Germans decreed that all the art houses had to close, the theater, the ballet, the orchestra, the movies. Were you already interested in the arts when that happened?
I was very much. Well, not interested. I was seduced because I was a child. Again, you know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And my brother, who is 12 years older than I am, he was like 23 years old. He was a set designer for a traveling small group, theater group company, which was playing operettas. And every time when they came to town where I was living with my relatives, you know, I was every day, I was backstage. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by the atmosphere of the theater. And because I was a little kid, you know, nobody kicked me out from the ladies' dressing room, right? So that was very, very exciting. And then, you know, I didn't know anything, you know, why it's happening. It was the most weird experience because I remember very well, Polish Blood is the name of the operetta. It's a very fluffy, light operetta. And this was 1944. And suddenly in the third act, during a very merry kind of a song, it was like a quartet or a quintet, and the ballet dancers and things on the stage, suddenly the singers stopped singing and started to cry, tears running down. And the orchestra stopped, conductor stopped. The people in the theater were sitting silently, quietly. Nobody was sort of upset or surprised. I just didn't know what's happening. Then the conductor tried to start the aria or the quintet again. They started to try to sing again this very merry, happy song. And again, in the middle of the song, they broke down and in tears and cried. And then the man came on the stage and said, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand the emotional state of the artist who will not be able to finish the performance today. Thank you for coming. It was so nice. Good night. And the curtain went down, and that was the end of culture. Because I didn't know that the day before, the Germans just canceled culture. The next day, every single singer, every single dancer, every single musician had to go and enlist himself or herself in a factories to work for the victory of the Third Reich.
My guest is film director Miloš Forman. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Miloš Forman is the director of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, and Amadeus. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround. Let me skip ahead to a few years after World War II, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia. Do you have specific memories of that?
I remember that, you know, it's, again, very, very strange thing to realize. I remember I was in the boarding school, and I was in the fifth grade and of the gymnasium, which was, you know. And we were traveling from the school in the nature, from the mountains, and when we were standing and waiting for another train on the train station in Mladá Boleslav, where from the loudspeakers is coming a speech by the then you know, Communist Party chairman Gottwald, announcing that the communists took over the country. We just you know, before we had any time to absorb the propaganda of this evasive social justice which the communists based their propaganda on, we didn't have time to be influenced by it. So when we heard this speech, we realized that this is totally hypocritical, you know, and unreal.
Were there things that you liked to do as a boy that you couldn't do after the communists took over because it was too bourgeois?
I never thought about these kind of things. You know, you adjust, especially in the communist society, because there are no alternatives. You mm-hmm. know, it's you are told what you can do, what you can't do, and if you don't want to do what you can do, you are not allowed to do anything. So you adjust, you know, you just accept the limitations imposed on you.
You ended up trying to go to theater school. You were rejected from theater school and ended up in film school, which I suppose was really lucky.
Well, for me, definitely.
Lucky break, yeah. Had you seen a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, yeah, in the film school. It was another paradox of communist society because it was the best school I could ever be going into because after the communists took over, they purged from public life the best writers, the best filmmakers, the best artists in the country because they were not enough in creating in the vein of socialist realism for them, so they purged them. But they couldn't kill them. They had to give them some chance to make a living. So make a meager living in teaching. They were not allowed to publish anything publicly, to books or make movies or work in the theater. But they were allowed to gain meager salary as professors. So the result was that at the film school we had the best minds, the greatest artists, you know, which were teaching us, which we could talk to.
Milan Kundera
was one of them.
Yeah, wrote Unbearable Lightness of Being was one of your teachers.
Yes, Book of Laughter and Forgetting, The Joke, you know, wonderful books.
One of the things that you did, I think this was while you were in film school or just afterwards, you hosted what you describe as a sort of Czech socialist realist Thursday night at the movies show on TV. So what was the show like? What made it the social realist version?
Well, the social realist version was that, first of all, the paranoia and of the communists to control every word which goes to the public. And television was only live. In that time, there was not Ampex and tapes at all. So it had to be live. So but they had to control everything. So you had to write everything down, learn it by heart, word by word. The censor was sitting somewhere watching you, checking if you are saying exactly the words which you had to send the text to the office, to the Bureau of Censors. They had to put a stamp on it, send it back to you, eventually make some corrections, you know. Then you had to learn it by heart, and then they were checking if you are saying it exactly, which was sometimes absolutely ridiculous because you are sort of, I was doing it like a improvised, like a live dialogue, conversation with somebody.
So what would you say to introduce a film? Do you remember any of the introductions you did?
All the introductions had to, you know, I was always trying to show on the television films which had some, you know, which were not just the propaganda films, but then, of course, that you had to present them in the way which the communists would accept if it was filmed from France, for example, if, I don't know, Children of Paradise, beautiful, romantic film, but you had to stress that this film is showing the cruelty of bourgeoisie, how it's suppressing the working class people, you know.
Did you believe any of that?
Of course not.
But you learned to say it.
Well, you say it because, you know, it's because everybody knew it's nonsense. Right. It's a game. It's right. a game, you know.
When you started writing yeah. and directing movies, did you have to avoid what government officials would have defined as bourgeois subject matter?
Well, that was something else. When you do the movies, you know, I tried not to speculate what would please them. And I was lucky. Because for some reasons, they think, you know, my first films were comedies, basically, in films in Czechoslovakia. And they perceive comedies as something not as important, something light, you know. Make it, you know, it's just funny, you know, it's just like that. So I was able to do these films very much the way I wanted to do them.
What kind of taste in movies did the cultural apparatchiks have?
Oh, that's how it's wonderful to work hard and to surpass the outcome of steel from his steel mill, 10% more than the steel mills in capitalist bourgeois decadent society. That was the greatest art. Now the basic, you know, the basic. Dilemma or paradox or discrepancy in the art philosophy is that what we are doing here, we are telling stories about life as it is, while the communist propaganda wants to tell and describe in the books or on the screen the life as it should be according to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so boring, you can't imagine.
One of the best known of your Czechoslovakian films was Fireman's Ball, and this was a comedy. And in the version that's in circulation now, I don't know when you put this part in. I mean, I know you put it in the late '60s. The film opens with you in front of the camera explaining that first of all, Fireman's Ball was released just before the Dubček leadership took over, and that the film had a very surprising reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned in protest against this film.
Well, they were ordered to resign. This film was banned. This film was banned right away when it was finished, and was banned officially, written for eternity.
No, why was it banned? You said comedies weren't considered as dangerous. Is this a comedy?
Well, they thought it's a metaphor on the Politburo and the Communist Party. You know, that Fireman's Ball Committee, right? That it's a metaphor for the whole leadership of the country, so they banned the film. No, for the, you know, that was orchestrated by the government people, this strike or the threat of practically all the volunteer firemen in the whole country to because they needed, you know, the people were so apathetic already, you know, they didn't give a damn. But of course, if the people read in the newspapers that, oh, well, tomorrow, if your house is on fire, just say, kiss the house goodbye, because the firemen are on strike, rightly, because they are upset about this film. So, you know, that turns people's anger against the artists, against the films, filmmakers, you know.
Were there any fires that you were accused of being personally responsible for? And did you feel responsible for any of it?
No. They didn't go on strike.
Oh, they didn't really go on strike.
They provoked this threat so that the government can say that they have a right to ban the film. So when the government banned the film, the firemen said, all right, so now we know that.
Director Miloš Forman is my guest. Now, where were you when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia?
I was in Paris in that time. I was in Paris working on a script for my first American movie. And that's where I learned about it.
And your family was still in Czechoslovakia?
My family was still there, but my French friends, Claude Berry and Paul Rassam, drove in car, which they borrowed from François Truffaut, to Prague to bring my wife and my children out which was such, again, such a, you know, ridiculously, absurdly funny story, you know, because they crossed the, when they, everything was fine, but when they crossed the border, the Czech population, when the so Russian army, you know, was occupying the country, just to confuse the Russians. So they either turned down or turned around all the street signs, all the signs on the roads, on the crossroads and everything. So they, you know, they, there was no way so that the Russians are confused and couldn't find anything. And it really took, you know, several weeks before they found some places of their interest. So when Claude Berry and Paul Rassam crossed the border going to Prague, suddenly they found themselves, you know, driving around and around, seeing deja vu places because all the, you know, signs on the roads were wrong. When they realized that they, you know, stopped, tried to stop some people, you know, and finally they stopped the motorcyclist who said, oh, yeah, I'm going to Prague, just follow me. And he started to drive. So they are now driving, following this motorcyclist. And in the middle of, you know, this wild ride through the countryside, the Pole suddenly had an urge to take a leak, right? So he said to Claude, stop, I have to take a leak. What do you mean to stop? You know, I stop and, I, you know, we'll lose him, we'll never find Prague. Well, what was this? Well, just open the window, roll around, you know, do it out of the window. So he climbed into the back seat of the car, and when he's doing it out of the rear window of the car, suddenly a colony of Russian tanks is coming against, you know. And they, you know, see, they could take this as a provocation. So Claude, by driving the car, you know, the car just grabbed, you know, Paul and just, you know, pulled him back into the car, and you know, he just sprinkled all over the François Truffaut's new Daimler, you know, car. And but then finally they reached Prague, and they brought my wife and my children out.
Film director Miloš Forman. His new memoir is called Turnaround. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Miloš Forman will be back with us in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Academy Award-winning director Miloš Forman. His films include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, and Amadeus. Forman is from Czechoslovakia, where he made his first internationally acclaimed films, Loves of a Blonde and The Fireman's Ball. In the second part of our interview, we talk about Forman's American films. The second film you made in the United States, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is one of your most famous films. It got a bunch of Academy Awards. You keep stressing the absurdity of stories that surrounded life under communism in Czechoslovakia. And you found out that you had been sent a copy of the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest years before you actually made the movie, but you never got it.
Well, that was Kirk Douglas who bought the rights for the book, you know, when it was even before it was published. And he loved the book and he wanted to make a movie, but never succeeded to get money to do it. But in that times, he was still hoping to do it. And he was in Prague on a goodwill mission, which was originated by President Kennedy. And he came to Prague because he did the adaptation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for Broadway, Kirk Douglas. And he starred in it on Broadway. And even there, you know, this adaptation at that time flopped. So suddenly he had time on his hands. So he accepted to go to Eastern Europe and Central Europe. So he went to Prague. They showed him one of my films. He liked it, and he asked me at the party if he can send me a book and if I would read it and tell him, you know. I said, of course, of course, of course. And, you know, the book never came, so I thought, well, that he, well, you know, another American big shot, you know. the moment he left the room, he already forgot, and okay. 10 years later, I'm already here in the United States, and I get a book in an envelope sent by the producers, Saul Zenz and Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son, if I would read it, and that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And, well, you know, I, of course, I said yes, it was the most fascinating, intelligent piece of literature in the Times I was offered and read. And when few weeks later I met Kirk, he said, "You chicks, you son of a bitches." I said, why are you saying that? "Well, listen, I was sending you 10 years ago this book, and you don't have even a courtesy to say, kiss off or something like that." And I told him, "Well, listen, this is, the same thing I thought about you." Well, what happened was he sent the book, but the censors at the customs confiscated the book as a subversive literature without informing Kirk Douglas that the book, or sending it back to Kirk Douglas, and without informing me.
So did Michael Douglas, when he sent you the book, did he know that his father had sent it to you 10 years before?
That's the funny thing. No, he didn't. It was some kind of a strange fate that the book came back again to me by Kirk's son and soul's aunts,
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is, of course, set in mental hospital, and you tell a really interesting story in your book about your experience in such an institution in Czechoslovakia. You say this was during a period when it was almost fashionable to have a nervous breakdown, because then you could kind of take a break for a while and get a little bit of rest. And so you had checked into an institution for a while and you met somebody there, and I'll let you tell the story.
Well, it was not only fashionable, it was some kind of a self-protection because in case you got in trouble with the authorities on the ideological front, it was somehow better if you could say, I'm a little mentally disturbed. I have a record of being treated in mental hospital,
I see. Uh-huh.
So for that reason, I was, going there, and of course I had to, pretend some symptoms so that they can really administer me something real. And they were putting in, me intravenously some kind of, I guess it was some kind of a sedative or I don't know. What was it? It was once a week I went there and I lie down on the bed in the room where there was like 40 other beds with the real patients there, in their gowns, hanging around. And for about half an hour I'm lying there and while this stuff is going into my vein. And one day this rather young, good-looking guy came. And, I learned one thing, which then I used, which very much formed my vision of Cuckoo's Nest. Before I entered the mental institution, went inside, I had a very ridiculous idea, because what I was expecting, people hanging on the chandeliers and yelling, "I am Jesus Christ," and going bananas. And here I entered, this institution there in Prague, and I see these poor souls, or they're trying desperately to look normal, And only then, and so this guy comes and he looks like very normal, and he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm making films." And he says, "Oh, I hate them. That's why I'm here." I said, "Why?" "Well, because, they got my wife. They want my wife to be in the films. My wife didn't want to go and make films. She wanted to stay with me, but they want, because they want to, can I say these words on radio or not? They want to have to abuse her, and so they so that I can protect her, they locked me here in the mental institution. Well, my wife is there with them, but I'll get out of here and I'll show them. I'll show them. You know my wife?" "So, well, you didn't tell me who she is." "Well, Jana Brejková." And that was my wife he's talking about. So I suddenly realized that this, rather reasonably, rationally looking guy is totally out of it.
Yeah, his delusion was that he was married to your wife.
He was delusion that he was married to my wife.
So what did you say? How did you handle that?
I said, "Oh, yeah, everybody knows Jana Brejková. Well, just tell them, when I'll get out, I'll get even with them." "So I'll tell them, sure, I'll tell them, yeah."
Did you tell your wife the story?
"Oh, yeah."
What was
yeah.
her reaction to it?
Well, she was scared.
My guest is film director Milos Forman. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Film director Milos Forman is my guest. He has a new memoir called Turnaround. I want to move on to your film Ragtime, which was, I can't remember if it was the last or just one of the last films that James Cagney was in.
That was, well, for the big screen, the last one, yes. He then after that did one film for television.
Americans have always thought of Cagney as, you know, like an icon of movies. What about growing up in Czechoslovakia? Were you familiar with his work from there?
No, not at all, because his films were not played in Europe. I'll tell you why.
Oh, because it glorified gangsters, right?
No. I mean, even before the war, or even in the archives, we didn't have his films.
Oh.
Because James Cagney speaks so fast. It's such a rapid-fire dialogue that his films were covered with subtitles from the top to bottom. So they were not successful because you couldn't see the actors because of the subtitles.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
So was it your idea to cast him?
Oh, yeah. Well, out of necessity, because, Ragtime was a pretty expensive film, and Dino De Laurentiis needed some name so that he can pre-sell the film, not here, but in Europe. He needed money from Europe, and so he needed a name. And we didn't have any name. And so I told James, you know, I'm making this movie. You know, it's whatever part you choose, it's yours. You want to play Evelyn Nesbitt, you'll be Evelyn Nesbitt. And he just laughed. He just laughed.
You know, if James Cagney helped sell the production abroad to Europe, I guess they were able to subtitle his movies easier than Czechs were able to subtitle
them?
Oh,
they dub. They dub.
Oh, they dub in Europe and they subtitle in Czechoslovakia. That explains it. Okay.
Germany, Italy, France, they all dub. And in England, they, you know.
Your last couple of movies haven't been as successful as your earlier ones. Valmont, which is based on the same story as Les Liaisons Dangereuses, but opened after the film adaptation of that Valmont flopped, and then Hell Camp, a movie that was in progress, never got made. What emotional impact did it have on you to have those two back to back?
The flop of Valmont doesn't really affect me because I did my best. I know that, and I like myself personally that film and that experience very much. And who has to grieve are the people who put up the money for the film, of course. I don't. The other case, that's worse, because, I work over a year and a half together with Adam Davidson on the script, and then I prepared the whole film with Michael Hausman as a producer. The cast was assembled here, the cast was assembled in Japan, the location found here, found in Japan, the sets were being built, and suddenly, you know, the film collapses, so that's not very pleasant.
Do you have something else in the works now?
I didn't decide yet. I have a few projects I'm sort of flirting with, but I didn't make up my mind yet, no.
So have you kept very emotionally involved with Czechoslovakia through the Velvet Revolution and more recently through the split between the Czech lands and Slovakia?
Yes, to a certain extent, mainly because my sons are living there. Of course, now, you know, they are coming and visit me very frequently. And of course, also because of my, you know, childhood friend or teenage years friend, Václav Havel, you know, who became president of Czechoslovakia, who was in the same boarding school in Czechoslovakia. And when I was 14, he was 11. It was a boarding school where, you know, there were the bedrooms, 8, 10 kids in one bedroom. So with the little kids, younger kids, always one older kid was there, like a, how would you call that person? You know, like a...
Like an older brother?
Like an older brother, right? And I was put on this one bedroom as an older brother to this, you know, 11-year-old kids. And I hated it because I was 14. And what kind of conversation that 14-year-old kid who starts already looking around the girl's legs, you know, can have with 11-year-old kids. So I hated it.
So Václav Havel was your younger brother?
And Václav Havel was there. He was the younger brother there, yes.
So So have you seen him since he became president?
Oh, yes, I have seen him. I have a great, great admiration for him, great admiration for him as a man and for him as a philosopher and politician.
Are you sorry your country split apart?
I guess yes and no. No, it's, you know, from the selfish point of view, for the Czechs are better without Slovaks because they were not able to agree on anything because the power in Slovakia is still in the hands of former communists and even former fascists, you know. And they were just not able to agree on anything. That country would, you know, stop at halt. So from this point of view, it's better for the Czechs, you know, that they are separated. But there's some nostalgia. It was, you know, it was nice to... It looked nice on the map, the whole country. I can't get used to the new shapes.
So let me ask you, in writing your memoir, Turnaround, and thinking back to your boyhood years during World War II, did you find yourself really marveling at everything you've been able to accomplish and the fact that, you know, that you survived and not only survived, but got to do something you desperately, you know, wanted to do and did it well and so on?
Well, you know, it's a funny business to write the autobiography. It's funny. It's a sin.
It's a sin?
It's a sin because you can't avoid a certain kind of narcissism in it. Mm-hmm. And narcissism mm-hmm. is a sin, mm-hmm. you know. But at the same time, you go through so many contradictory feelings because it's like, it's almost as if, you know, you are the defendant, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge all at once.
Right.
You know? And of course, you know, as a defendant, I am yelling, you know, I'm good, I'm good. And but the prosecutor in me is saying, no, you are not. You are selfish, you are arrogant, you are greedy, you know. And it goes like that. And then the book is out. And
then the critics become the judge and jury.
Then the critics will tell you, right? But, you know, then the book is out, and it's, again, such an ambiguous, kind of very contradictory feeling because on one hand, suddenly, you know, I feel like I'm embarrassed. I feel like I'm standing naked in the middle of Times Square.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I get very angry if nobody pays any attention to me.
Miloš Forman, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been a pleasure.
You are very welcome. I thank you.
Film director Miloš Forman has written a memoir called Turnaround. This is Fresh Air.